Administrator Sessa and Carter, David R. Tyson Jr., E.T. Marcus, and public counsel, W.S. Durham Gallery, Harold E. Johnson, Appalachian Council.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is David Simonson, together with co-counsel Keith Marcus, seated at council table. We represent Chauncey M. Elliott, who is the administrator of the estate of her son, Caleb McKinley Smith. We are asking the court to reverse the summary judgment entered against our client, the appellant plaintiff below, and remand this matter for trial on the issue of whether Trevor Carter was grossly negligent on June 25th, 2011. On June 25th, 2011, Caleb was 13 years old. He was a Boy Scout. It was a very happy day for him because he was on a camp out with his Troop 215 along the Rappahannock River. On the morning of June 25th, he had been given a swimming lesson by Trevor Carter. Trevor Carter was 16 years old. He was the senior patrol leader of this troop. He was an experienced swimmer who had life-saving skills as an excellent, experienced swimmer. He was giving Caleb a swimming lesson that morning because Caleb could not swim. He was trying to learn how to swim, but he could not swim. Clearly, Mr. Carter knew that. Later in the morning, around 11 a.m., Trevor Carter, in this position of authority, someone that Caleb naturally looked up to. Mr. Carter was an athletic young man, good swimmer, again with the life-saving skills. Trevor Carter led Caleb out into the river on a partially submerged sandbar. Caleb had no protective gear, no life jacket, being taken out into the river. And again, Mr. Carter knew he could not swim. In effect, Mr. Carter was the protective gear, was the protection for Caleb as Caleb was let out into this river. When they reached the end of this sandbar, about 150 yards, a considerable distance out into the river, with no prior warning, unexpected to all concerned, Mr. Carter left the sandbar, along with the other swimmer that was with him on the sandbar, left the sandbar, began swimming back to shore. He made the statement, fairly self-evident, to Caleb, "You walk back." An unnecessary statement. What else was Caleb going to do? He couldn't swim. They all knew that. He wasn't going to remain at the end of the sandbar for an indefinite time period. But he's just told, "Hey, walk back," and Mr. Carter swims away. As they proceed back, the record not entirely clear on exactly how long after Mr. Carter swims away it occurs, but the if that occurs is Caleb slips and falls into the water. Once a commotion is raised, because not only Caleb slips and falls into the water, but another non-swimmer accompanying Caleb in this trek out to the end of the sandbar is Elijah Morris.
So should the defendant have foreseen that the victim would have slipped and fell into the water?
Absolutely.
So it's grossly negligent, for example, under that thesis, to take a non-swimmer to the edge, for example, of a dock because they might fall into the water and drown?
A dock is not a partially submerged sandbar into a major river that has currents acting within it. A dock is a fixed physical structure, and I don't think it's an appropriate analogy to say you take someone out on the edge of a dock. Now, if you took someone out to the edge of a dock who was unstable, who was at known risk of falling into the water, as Caleb was at a known risk on a slippery, partially submerged sandbar, if you take them out at the end of that dock, 150 yards out into a body of water with currents, and then unexpectedly just leave them there and say, "Oh, you can walk back," and maybe the person that took them out at the end of the dock jumps in the water and starts swimming away, I think that could possibly be gross negligence, depending upon the specific facts of the case. But I don't think the Dock example, with respect, Justice, is really a good analogy of what occurs here.
The defendant here, though, had accompanied the victim, the plaintiff, rather, across the sandbar. He'd seen the plaintiff, you know, make it, and there's no evidence that there was any risk observations made at that time, as far as I understand. Am I right or wrong on that?
I don't think the record shows whether anyone, I don't know exactly what you mean by observed.
In other words, if the walk out there, you know, three guys fell, and the currents came out of nowhere, and all of a sudden it looked more scary than anyone thought it was going to be walking out on a sandbar. Actually, you get in negligence territory. I'm still not sure you get in gross negligence territory, but I don't see anything in the record that suggests that at the time the defendant swam away with the instruction that the plaintiff should go back the way he came, that there was something that in the defendant's mind which would have said, oh my gosh, don't take that risk. That's a lack of all care to let him walk back by himself with the other kids.
There's no care shown. I think the question you might be raising is the fact that they made it out there on a partially submerged sandbar, which could be slippery, into a body of water current, is the fact they made it out, meaning that it was established there's no risk to being out on the sandbar. And I think the answer to that is no. The fact that you can do something unsafe once does not mean that it is not unsafe, that it is not imprudent to do it again.
But I think the question is, what would make one think it was unsafe for him to walk back on the sandbar?
Because it was unsafe.
Why?
Because to take a non-swimmer without a life jacket out on 150 yards into a river that is a major river that does have currents, on a partially submerged sandbar, which by common knowledge could be slippery, someone could fall into the water from that sandbar, that is not safe. The only reason, well, I shouldn't say the only reason, when Caleb went out on that sandbar, he had his swimming instructor, the authority person, the senior patrol leader, the older young man, with him that would provide protection.
All right, but evidently it wasn't needed.
On the way out, it wasn't on
Correct.
The way back, it was. And he died because he didn't have it. He died because Mr. Carter had left him out on that sandbar and had swum away. And what the circuit court focused on, this is on page 6 of his letter opinion, it's page 67 in the joint appendix, it's clear that what the circuit court did to say this was not gross negligence on the part of Mr. Carter was that after he had swum away from where Caleb was at the end of the sandbar, and then Caleb falls in, it's unclear exactly how long, but he falls in, he has enough time, somewhat tragically to say, to yell for help three times. And in that time, however long it was, Mr. Carter had swum too far away to be able to swim back to where Caleb was.
But it sounds like he was close enough to hear.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He was close enough to hear the call for help.
I don't know that it's in the record that Mr. Carter heard the call. What is in the record, I think, clearly is there was commotion when he went in. Some on shore may have heard and then began yelling, calling attention. Whether Mr. Carter actually heard Caleb or not, he got the message that Caleb had fallen in the water. He turns around and tries to swim back. He's too far away at that point. That's the key point.
But while that, of course, is not in the least bit dispositive, surely it's relevant, because if Mr. Carter had turned around and seen the boy drown, just say, I'm not worried about that, I want to get back and get a Coca-Cola on shore, there's no doubt the plaintiff would be able to bring that circumstance into the record to show that the mens rea of this tortfeasor was gross negligence at the time he put the child in that risk.
If we add that background, it almost becomes an intentional tort. I mean, if he actually had seen him slip and fall, struggling to survive, and it simply continued away.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying logically, the fact, whether it goes one way or the other, is still relevant. It's obviously not dispositive.
I'm not saying it's not relevant. I'm just saying that we don't really have in the current record before this court Mr. Carter's, whether he heard one, two, or three yells for help, exactly what caused him. He did, it is undisputed. He turned around on his, he was swimming ashore. He turned around, it's undisputed that when he became aware, however he became aware, he turned around and began to swim back. I think one of the real focuses of the case in the way the circuit court ruled, the very fact he just turned around to try to swim back unsuccessfully to where Caleb was and was drowning meant that care had been given. And our argument is very straightforward. The combination of what Mr. Carter did, taking him out there into the river, which was unsafe to do that with a non-swimmer, perhaps safe enough as long as Mr. Carter remained with him, but he had life-saving skills as a swimmer. To take him out there is one thing. Then to leave him there, abandon him there, and swim away, putting himself in a position of no longer being able to get to the place where Caleb could slip into the water, as he did, and drown, that is an utter disregard of prudence, amounting to a complete neglect of Caleb's safety. That is the standard, that is the factual question this court has said is put to the jury in determining whether or not it is gross negligence. And I think fundamentally in this case, what the appellee is doing is trying to raise a whole series of factual quibbles or factual questions, which at the end of the day in no way justify the circuit court barring a jury, a reasonable juror, from concluding that the series of things that Mr. Carter did was in fact an utter disregard of prudence, amounting to a complete neglect of Caleb's safety. Had Mr. Carter only let him out there and then brought him back, whereupon, if in fact in the dangerous, hazardous situation in which Caleb had been placed, had he gone into the water, Mr. Carter would have been right there to offer assistance. That would be one thing. That didn't happen. So in this case, we look at everything that occurred, and we find that what happened in total, what Mr. Carter did in total, leading him out there as an authority supervisory figure, putting him into the water, and then abandoning him there, leaving him to his fate, that is gross negligence. Or at least, it creates a factual question for a jury.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
My own analysis is trying to determine how different or how similar this is to Volpe. One of the key factors for this court in Volpe was that the danger was both was not open and obvious, that it was hidden, and that it was a man-made danger that was very well known to the defendant city. Now, at first blush, this danger also is not open and obvious because it's under the water. Yet the young man walked across it once, so he was aware of that it was there. How do you? And I'll ask the opposite question of your opposing counsel. How do you draw this closer to Volpe under those circumstances?
I think it is like Volpe in that in Volpe, the body of water is open and obvious. And that can be said here. The body of water is open and obvious. What was not open and obvious in Volpe was the hydraulic effects and currents produced on the particular day, which in that case, the person who died had not experienced before. So the fact that the body of water itself is open and obvious was not determinative in any way. And as you just noted, Justice Mims, it was effectively man-made because they did not do anything to prevent this situation at the Slowhead Dam in the Volpe case.
And they were, in fact, responsible for it.
They were responsible for it.
And the issue of negligence versus gross negligence could have turned upon the fact that not only did they know well of this danger, but that they, in fact, were responsible for the danger. They had caused the danger.
In this case, the fundamental danger which caused the death was man-made in that Trevor Carter left Caleb Smith out on that sandbar.
Well, not only that, but led him out.
He led him out to the sandbar, which is man-made.
So this would be like Volpe if an employee of the city of Lexington had led these kids on a field trip, hey, go swim in this dangerous spot.
And it takes
so it's
them out
worse.
And then left them in the combination of negligence, which either one could be thought of as gross, but when you combine them, he leads them out, puts them in, that's man-made in effect. He then abandons them there, that's man-made in effect. And there is the fact in the case that there were currents in this body of water. There's absolutely no evidence that Caleb had knowledge of this particular body of water, of the currents that could affect, operate in this cove off the main body of the river itself. So I think...
Did Carter have knowledge of the currents, or what, whether it was a flood tide, or what the particular hydraulics of that waterway was?
Let me answer it this way. He had more knowledge of the condition of the water than would Caleb. I don't know that I can point you to the current record before the court in that. But, Your Honor, I think that
how close was the sandbar to the channel?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How close was the sandbar and where the incident happened to the channel?
When you say channel, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Is there a navigable portion of this area of the river?
This is essentially a cove off the main river, which does have currents operating within it.
Do we know what the depths are of that particular? Is that in the record?
The depth right next to the sandbar is not that deep. I think it was only 7 or 8 feet. And I don't believe the distance from the sandbar to the main river is all that great. Maybe a few hundred yards, but, Your Honor, that's
not... My question is, did the defendant in this gross negligence tort action, have you alleged that the defendant had knowledge of these unique things? This is a 16-year-old boy.
We don't. There are not facts that alleged current in the record on the specifics of what Carter knew about the currents specific to that place in the river. It is conceded and admitted and agreed, however, that this was an open and obvious dangerous body of water. The appellee in this case has made the same point.
I apologize. I took you over your limit.
So we ask that the trial court be reversed and the matter remanded for trial. Thank you.
Thank you. I have one more question.
Yes,
you indicated
sir.
That it is conceded that it is open and obvious?
That has been one of the major points of the defense of this case, that in fact any body of water is an open and obvious hazard, an open and obvious danger. That has been a point made in their briefs and otherwise in the record of this case.
And your response to that is?
My response to that is in general, yes, bodies of water are known to be hazardous, particularly for a non-swimmer. The key point in this case, though, is earlier in the morning he died, he had been given a swimming lesson by Mr. Carter in this body of water. He had Mr. Carter with him. No problem, no risk perceived. He was led out onto the sandbar by Mr. Carter, the authority figure, the supervisory figure, the senior control leader, who he felt safe in the water with. He was with Mr. Carter.
Okay.
Led out and left.
Okay. Counsel, what do you believe was the duty owed by Mr. Carter to Caleb?
Other than a general duty of supervision and care because of his position within the troop, it would be that once he leads him out into that body of water on that partially submerged sandbar, slippery sandbar, he assumed a duty to care for him in that body of water, in that river.
But what's his duty? I mean, what does this duty to care for him mean?
To operate with reasonable care would be the general duty. What we say is a factual question properly determined by a jury is whether he showed an utter disregard of prudence.
But you're saying that his duty was to exercise reasonable care for Caleb's safety. It sounds like
that would be the general duty once he assumes a duty. As this court has held, I think there's a general duty because of the relative positions of these two young men. You have Trevor Carter, the senior patrol leader, an authority figure to Caleb. He had given Caleb swimming lesson earlier in that morning. He then leads and takes Caleb out onto that partially submerged sandbar into the river. He has a duty at that point to act appropriately to the circumstances. He does not. He shows an utter lack of care for Caleb in taking him out there and then leaving him out there.
And taking him out without any kind of...
No protective gear, no life jacket, exactly. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Galilee, and I represent the defendant Trevor Carter. May it please the court. The law of gross negligence in Virginia is clear, and this court has applied it consistently in every case in the history of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Gross negligence is complete neglect. It is the absence of even slight care. So while you can debate whether the care was adequate or not, if there is any fact which shows even slight care, there's no gross negligence as a matter of law. And that's what this court has held in every case involving gross negligence.
But isn't that a question for the jury?
Not when there are undisputed facts that show that there was some care. There's not been one case cited by the appellant where there has been a fact showing care and it's been allowed to go to the jury. Not one case.
Okay, well, let's begin with them on the island. We're not talking about that morning or the day before. Let's begin with on that island. Mr. Carter says, I'm swimming back. You walk back.
Right.
Where is the slight care there?
Well, the care, of course, before that is given in swimming lessons.
One lesson.
That morning.
Could he swim after the one swim lesson?
So, again, that may go to whether the care was adequate. You may say he should have had more lessons.
But
he didn't do nothing.
But that's a question for the jury.
No, that's a fact. This court has said in the Volpe case. The Volpe case was a case where there was a hidden hydraulic. And the court said that we agree that the natural, ordinary dangers of the Moy River were open and obvious. We do not agree that a hidden hydraulic created by an unusually strong current was open and obvious. But then the court said twice, and that's why it was so important, the court said twice, in this case, the city took no safety precautions. Mm-hmm. None. No precautions.
What safety precaution did Mr. Carter take here? The swim lesson.
The swim lesson.
Okay, what else?
That may be slight, but it's a precaution. Two, he told him that they said there was no notice given. That's what they say in the brief. But it's an established fact, admitted as a request for admission, that he said, we are going to swim back. So they told him that he was going to swim back. And then importantly, and
how does that show care?
If he had
just left without saying anything?
Just left without saying anything. That would have shown.
If he had left without saying anything, would the decedent have been in any better or worse condition than he was trapped on that island?
I don't think it would have made necessarily any difference. But again, you can argue whether or not you
can argue. It's potentially not relevant to the negligence versus the gross negligence.
I think it is relevant because, again, it shows some care. He cared enough to say, I'm going to swim back. I'm a 16-year-old kid. Hey, I'm going to swim back. You're a 13-year-old kid. We walked out on here together. He didn't tell him to swim back. He didn't tell him to come join me. He said to walk back.
The way he came was perfectly safe. There's no suggestion otherwise.
Exactly.
To walk back on a sandbar where there is no suggestion that there was any unique knowledge that somehow the poor child would fall into the water, which could happen if the child were standing on a pier somewhere.
Exactly, and I think about that analogy because I thought about myself. I've taken my children to the lake, and I've walked them out onto the pier, and then I've walked back up to the porch. And you know, they could potentially fall off the pier and drown.
Right, but you're in the middle of the river. You're in the middle of the river. Your feet are planted on a slippery sandbar, and there's currents around. That's not the same as just standing on a pier on the edge of the lake.
Well, falling off a pier into a lake, I submit there's a pretty good analogy.
But my biggest problem is, and the difference with Volpe, is Volpe, they just on their own go swimming. And then the city's aware of this dangerous condition, but there's no posting of signs or whatever. Here, it's the affirmative act of leading them into the danger in the first place. Why doesn't that take... It's something beyond Volpe.
Well, again, Your Honor, I don't think it's beyond Volpe. Volpe was a man-made hydraulic that sucks you under. And the city knew about it, and the city invited people. It's a fact that the city invited people to swim there. And so that plaintiff in that case was an invitee, and that's clear in the record. And so that, I believe, is more dangerous.
Well, invite as I mean, there's one thing to say an invitee in a technical legal sense, and another thing for the city to lead a group of school children on a swimming excursion or whatever.
They invited people to swim there. There was a public swimming facility for them, and that's in the record. And so you have a hidden hydraulic, where here you simply have young boys who are scouts going out on a sandbar into the river, a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old.
But the 16-year-old is the only person in a position of authority over the 13-year-old at that time.
Well, it's in the record, it's undisputed, that there are four adults on the shore watching. That's been pled. And
but they are not exercising their authority at the time. The 16-year-old has led the 13-year-old into a position of danger and then abandons him.
Well, Your Honor, again, he doesn't abandon him in the sense that he tells him to walk back. Now again, you can say that's not enough care.
What else could he do? If Mr. Carter had said nothing, what were the options that were available?
He could have said, you can jump in and swim back with me, I'll help you. He could have said...
But that would be inconsistent with the abandonment that the facts show occurred here.
Right. That would be inconsistent with showing some care. And that's what he did. He showed some care by saying that if you don't jump in the water, don't go swimming. He didn't encourage him to go in the water. He encouraged him to walk back on the sandbar, to go back to the shore the same way that you would come to this point. So if he didn't care about him, if he didn't care whether or not he drank, and that's what gross negligence has to be in this case, that Trevor Carter did not care whether or not Caleb Smith drowned, he would not have told him to walk back. And then he wouldn't have tried to rescue him immediately once he was in the water.
You see, well, the subsequent efforts... I'm not sure that they do bear upon the care at the time that the injury occurred. But we are not a jury. And this seems to be the argument that one would make to a jury about whether there is simple negligence or gross negligence, which is why perhaps this case needs to go to a jury. We're not here to determine.
It would be a
Excuse me. We are not here to determine whether there was gross negligence or whether there wasn't gross negligence. We are here to determine whether it would be appropriate for a jury to determine that.
I agree that that is the issue. And the law is that there cannot be any evidence of even slight diligence. It has to be the want of even scant care. It has to be complete neglect, like in Volpe, where you take no precautions. Here, he told the child to, one child telling another child to walk back on the sandbar. That's the degree of care. You may argue whether or not that was adequate, but adequacy is not the issue of gross negligence. It's indifference. Adequacy is not the issue.
It's wholesale, wanton, completely zero care.
Zero. And again, if the court wanted to change the law, it would be a sea change. And I submit that there's going to be a change in the law of gross negligence, which would impact every charity in the state and ruin volunteerism. then let the legislature do it. This court shouldn't take this case. And I know this case is shocking in the sense that anytime there's a death of a child, it's shocking. But these are children on a sandbar. That's all this case is. And the older child told the younger child, walk back. Don't do what I'm doing. Don't swim back. Don't follow me. You walk back the same way you walked out. And then the record is clear, and they say in their brief the fact that Carter immediately began a rescue attempt after Carter had slipped into the water is not indicative of relevant care. What could be more relevant?
It would certainly be relevant if Carter saw the boy drowning and said, I'm not worried about that.
I gave you a swimming lesson this morning.
Yeah,
that's good. You're on your own. He tried to rescue him immediately. And their argument that once you're in a position of danger,
If you're in a position of authority and you see someone drowning and you say, I'm not even going to help you because I gave you a swimming lesson this morning, that's not gross negligence. That's willful and wrong. That, I mean, really, that does not help your argument.
I think it does. It will be more relevant in a drowning case than to try to save someone from drowning and to try to rescue someone. What could show more care? And to say that just because you're in a position of danger, that the inquiry stops, the Colby case, which this court decided, so that wasn't clear. That's where a police officer was speeding and ran a red light, clearly put the plaintiff in danger. The dangerous situation had already been created. But this court says the police officer gets off because he had to brake and swerve. I mean, that was enough. He showed some care.
Wasn't he going something like 5 miles above the speed limit?
No, that was the other case.
Right.
That was the other police case where they were that was the Meager case. In the Colby case, he was speeding, ran a red light, and at that point, the plaintiff in his car, he was already, the dangerous condition had already been created. That accident was going to happen. But because the police officer tapped his brakes and swerved, even though he still hit the plaintiff, this court said he showed some care. Now, a jury could have argued, and you could argue, have argued to a jury, well, maybe it wasn't adequate, but that's not the test. It has to be no care, complete neglect. And when you tell a 16-year-old child, tell the 13-year-old child, you walk back to shore the same way you walked out, and when he fell into the water, he immediately tried to rescue you. That's showing some degree of care. It may be inadequate care, but it is some care. And the Supreme Court, this court, has said in every case involving gross negligence, where there's some care, there's no negligence. And that's what we have in this case. And you look at the case, not only the police officer is protected, but the city's protected. In the Frazier case, there's a 13-year-old standing next to a big gaping hole in the floor. And in that case, the city violated its own code. The city had barriers which it did not use. And the city had an incident like that 2 years before. And in spite of all that, the city gets protection because this court said the danger was open and obvious.
But that's a premises liability case. And
well,
this
again,
is not.
Well, this is a case where the danger of drowning is open and obvious, just like that hole in the floor was open and obvious. So this court has often said that when you have an open and obvious danger, that negates gross negligence. And that's what the Volpe case said. The Volpe case not only agreed that the natural, ordinary encounter dangers of the river were, as a matter of law, open and obvious, but because it was a hidden hydraulic, and because the city took no safety precautions. Again, I keep repeating
that. And I want to deal with the open and obvious, because if the danger is the sandbar, then at that point, one can argue that it is open and obvious to Caleb, because he's already walked upon it. But if the danger is the current, then one can argue the opposite, that it is not open and obvious because the current would have been different at different times of day. And so, again, that is a fact that would appear to be a jury question.
You know, this court ruled, if you look at the language of the Washabal case, It said that the rivers, with their currents, are open and obvious. That everyone knows rivers have currents. They change at different times. The court specifically addressed...
Do 13-year-olds know that it changes from time to time?
I'm sorry?
Does a 13-year-old know that it changes from time to time?
I don't know that a 13... I think, well, you know, I only know in the record that they admitted in the record, page 23, that, a request for admission that said, quote, Caleb Smith knew the dangers of drowning in water.
Knew the dangers of drowning in water.
Yes.
Well, that's okay. That's, but that doesn't deal with the vicissitudes of a river current.
Well, again, Supreme Court addressed that argument. That's all I can say on it. The Supreme Court addressed that argument. It specifically said that rivers and currents are issues that are open and obvious to all. And that was a case involving the drowning of a 9-year-old.
Is there any evidence in the record that this 16-year-old defendant knew of the vicissitudes of this river, or that the current was going one way or the other way, or was going at one half knot or three knots, or
no,
whether it was
you know,
3 feet in width or 30 feet in width?
Of course not. I don't think anybody could know what was going on underneath the water. How could you know?
Well, not a 16-year-old Boy Scout, but maybe someone from Virginia Institute of Marine Science.
Perhaps. Maybe it's safe, but not 13
Your time has expired. The court will be adjourned.